All right, we are back. In this segment, we are joined by our good friend Stuart Gardner, who was on the program some weeks ago. Stuart, when we talked about the DSM, psychiatry in the courtroom, the Stainer case, etc. So welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
Did you have any comments about your little segment that you talked about the law and the use of the DSM?
Oh, no. In fact, one thing I saw that was amazing to me was an article in the SACB just a few days ago talking about the DSM-5. It's going to come out, I think, in 2004, and they're talking about relationship mental disorders where, you know, husband and wife are fighting, and maybe you kill the wife, and you had a mental disorder which had to do with a relationship. So I can't wait to see the new DSM-5.
So now we're going to now basically excuse murder of your spouse because, you doggone it, you're mentally ill.
Well, if it's in the DSM-5, maybe.
I see. Well, psychiatry, once again, is doing the legal profession a rather large favor.
Yeah, you got to find those technicalities.
We should review, of course, for our audience that you are, in fact, a practicing attorney, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Uh-huh. Yeah, your article that you brought over here recently, the Scene, section of the Sacramento Bee, dated September 10th, 2002, does indeed, on review here, note that the American Psychiatric Association is considering adding, quote, relationship disorders, unquote, to the list of mental illnesses. You know, I think most married couples are a bit batty after a while, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I definitely think that's a mental disorder if you're married. The way you could also use that, though, is if you were having a problem with your boss, you could say that, hey, I have a mental disorder, and under the Americans with Disabilities Act, I'm entitled to get a reasonable accommodation, which means I don't have to deal with that boss. So
your
anymore.
Boss yells at you. You then say this is exactly. Discrimination based on the fact that you have a relationship disorder with said boss.
Perfect. You've got it.
I did want to basically just round out our discussion since we talked about it some weeks back about the fact that that Stainer, Carrie Stainer, has been judged sane to stand trial in federal court and convicted. Judged sane to stand trial in state court. He was subsequently convicted. And now we, the taxpayer, are buying a fifth trip on the merry-go-round of deciding whether Stainer is sane for the penalty phase. What's up with this?
Oh, you know, I wish I could explain it better, but it's a sad state of affairs the way that this kind of merry-go-round works, and it's really just to assure that he gets a fair trial.
Well, but he's had a fair trial, hasn't he? I mean,
well, Doug, I agree with you. We're kind of preaching to the choir here.
But the taxpayer, you and I paid for 6 weeks of psychiatric testimony already.
Yep.
Where psychiatrists were talking about how he analyzed ink blots and, you know, how, you know, what he delusions he may be having, how, interpreted his dreams, told us about his PET scans.
It's just assuring that the guy actually is sane enough to execute him.
Later on appeal, it'll stick.
I don't know if you remember, Doug, but there was a young man down in Texas that was executed a number of years ago, I think Bill Clinton, during his watch, and they were giving him his last meal, and the guard asked him, hey, why don't you eat that last pork chop? You know, this is your favorite meal. He said, oh, I'm saving it till tomorrow. And they executed
him. I think that's an old wives' tale. I think that's the guy like the guy that rode down the beam on the 87th floor in the World Trade Tower. I'm not sure that happened.
That's the story I heard, and we just want to make sure that this guy is sane enough so we can execute him.
Well, this may be an unfair question because I know you haven't studied and are not up on it, and I'm certainly not. But when I went on the web, I discovered that in the wake of the Dan White trial in 1978, where he was supposedly depressed, and the Twinkie defense claimed that he had a diminished capacity because he was depressed, and therefore he only got 6 years for gunning down the mayor of San Francisco and supervisor Harvey Milk. There was a widespread outrage in the wake of that finding. In 1982, California voters eliminated the supposed diminished capacity defense with the Victims' Right Initiative in 1982. But if diminished capacity isn't the defense, then why are we spending all this time on how insane Stainer is? Various degrees of how insane he may be. I don't get it.
Yeah, if you're a criminal defense attorney, you do everything to protect your client, and you look for outs. And if you can figure out an out, such as a Twinkie defense, you take it because that helps your client. And sure, there's outrage, and then that law gets changed, but it doesn't stop criminal defense attorneys from looking for different outs. That's their job. They're trying to protect their client. Whether or not he's guilty is immaterial. Their job is to fight for their client.
Well, okay, students and professors are no doubt returning to King Hall here in the fall for the fall quarter here at UCD.
Sure.
And I would ask them to respond to our website to info@radioparallax.com. In regards to this sort of broader philosophical question, what is with this concept that lawyers have an obligation to help their clients no matter what? What about their obligation to protect society, say, from serial killers? You're supposed to give a fair trial. You're not supposed to railroad anybody. But how has it crept into law schools over the years, or somehow seeped into American legal thinking, that you pull out all the stops and do everything possible to help your client, even if it's to the detriment of society at large?
Actually, attorneys have many canons of ethics, and your duty of loyalty to your client is number one. But there is a duty to society in general. So you can't go out and lie to the jury, and you can't go out and lie and misrepresent things to the court. The primary duty is to your client. You never, as a defense attorney, you never go and ask your client, you did this right. You always start out, well, look, you're charged with, you know, murder. And for murder, you need to go out with a mental state, commit an act causing death. And the elements are those four. Now, but if any of those four aren't met, then you're not guilty. And so then you start and you ask them what happened based upon this question. You don't go out and say, well, you killed him, didn't you? Because if he told you yes, that would lessen your opportunity to represent this person.
This just makes me squirm hearing this. I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was a lawyer, and she told me, you know, about what you're informed of in law school, legal ethics. And she said that if your client tells you that he's guilty or in some way lets you know that what he did was, you know, that he committed a crime, and there's been a misrepresentation to the court that he is innocent, that lawyers are, by their code of ethics, required to then notify the court that there's been some sort of misrepresentation of the guy's status. And I asked her, have you ever heard of a lawyer doing that? And she said, no.
No, you would never do that.
But doesn't it come up? Shouldn't that come up routinely? Shouldn't that be a routine matter of jurisprudence in this country that you have to say, Your Honor, I have to let you know, I was talking to the client. He does admit that he did all this, and the stuff he denied earlier was all a pack of lies under oath.
Actually, the way the criminal justice system works is almost everything is plea bargained.
95%, is it?
Yeah, I believe it's at least 95. I know with civil cases, I think it's 99, but I think with criminals, I think it's a little higher than 95.
Yeah.
And in the plea bargain, you have to admit you did it. There's a factual basis for the plea. That's what happens when there's a plea bargain. But if there's no plea bargain, you're taking the baby all the way, and you would never go out and you try not to admit anything. You try not to stipulate to any facts. You make the prosecutor prove everything beyond a reasonable doubt.
Your client more or less tells you, okay, here's what I did, yada, 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 or tells you a mixture of lies and truth. You as an attorney make an evaluation of where you think this is going. And then the two of you have to decide, or you have to decide with him, do we want to plea bargain out or do we want to go to trial? And I guess sometimes against better judgment, the client says, I want to go to trial on this.
Sure. And you'd be shocked. I've represented a lot of criminals and their stories change all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really know when they're telling the truth and when they're not. And you actually, after a while, you realize that you don't know when the police are lying or telling the truth. Also, mm-hmm. I mean, people see things in different ways.
The natural tendency of people to see things the way they would have them be.
Exactly. I've never had a client that said, oh, yeah, I did it completely. Yeah, you know, I'm going to testify that I did it completely. They never say that. There's always some sort of excuse if you're going to take it all the way through trial. I mean, the people that say, yeah, I did it, I'm guilty, get me the best deal you can. You go in there and you just negotiate the best deal you can. But for the trials, you know, Kerry Stainer's perfect example. This guy's facing death. If he's nuts, then you wouldn't really believe his story in the first place.
Hmm.
But there's a difference. I mean, we're not looking for the truth.
There's a concept of people growing up on Perry Mason and Matlock and watching court dramas. There's this idea in the layman's mind somewhere that a courtroom battle is in some sense a search for truth. And it's been my sort of gradual understanding that attorneys have no such illusions.
It's much more like a football game.
It's adversarial.
Sure it is.
Always.
Yes.
You're taking a side and you're doing your best to drive down the field.
Yes, and sometimes you feel real bad about it. Yeah, you know, when you know or you feel like your guy has probably done it, and you feel like you're completely winning. Mm-hmm. It's a good feeling to feel like you're winning, but on the other hand, you know, you might be releasing somebody back out into society that probably shouldn't be there because they're a danger. But you have to have faith in the system.
Well, I'm glad that someone does. Generally, people with a JD after their name are about the only people I know that have much faith in the system.
You know, wait a second. I want to say something here. It was almost 150 years ago, Lincoln said, "Our system's the worst system, except for all the other systems." No one's come up with a system that works a lot better.
Well, in a future show, and we won't do this today, but in a future show, let's address how much improvement we could make in the system by getting rid of, as it is presently constructed, the American jury system. The O.J. Simpson trial, a case in point. If you want to have a system guaranteed to gum up the works, where we ask citizens to give up whatever they're doing, I mean, certainly we have obligations as citizens.
Yeah, we could talk about citizens. We could talk about the jury system forever.
The state government or county government doesn't ever say to us, you know what, it's important that we have clean streets. Therefore, on Thursday of next week, please report down to the, the county courthouse so that you can be given a broom, or perhaps be among those who may be selected to take up a broom and clean the city streets. And yet we don't bat an eyelash when you're asked to go down and give up whatever you're doing for 2 weeks to serve on a jury. Yeah. It's wacky.
It's an interesting system, and the evolution of the jury system. We could talk about that for hours.
I think we should, but of course, not today. We're talking today about, I guess, adversarial system, and what happens? I've noticed that there's something very peculiar about what happens to people who come off the street and decide they're going to be lawyers, and they enter these hallowed, ivy-covered halls and become these things called lawyers that Americans love to make jokes about.
It's an incredible metamorphosis.
Tell us about
attorneys. Attorneys really start out almost universally as very idealistic, good people that want to go out and serve and do justice and represent people so that they can get to a fair result. And then you start law school and they begin beating that out of you. And it starts almost instantaneously. I'll never forget one of my first weeks in law school. The professor said, "Okay, everybody who thinks that murderers should be punished with a long prison sentence, raise their hand." And of course, a bunch of young, eager law students that we all shot our hands straight up. And then he said, "Well, what if I changed the facts and I said that the murderer was the daughter of the father, and she murdered him after he begged her to kill her while he was in the hospital suffering horribly from a terminal illness, and he was so whacked out and drugs he couldn't function because of all the pain, and it was just lingering and lingering and lingering, and all of you young lawyers want to send this poor little daughter off to the jail for a long prison term." That's what you said, isn't it? Yeah, it just starts there, and then you realize...
Oh, what a lawyer's trick! Beware! Oh, yeah.
Yes, but certainly with the Socratic method, when you get 100 young students in there with one law professor, and this law professor singles you out, for instance, and just starts chewing you a new one. And if you go left, he just whips on you to the right. You realize after a while that this guy's not seeking justice, and I'm getting my butt kicked, and it's embarrassing. And you reward people in law school for taking a position and defending it. You don't reward somebody for being wishy-washy wimp. And that's not really what people hire attorneys for. I mean, you and I were talking about...
It's very goal-oriented.
Yep. You hire a pit bull. Somebody is just out there to fight for you, tooth and nail. That's what you want out of an attorney, and that's what we create as a society, and that's what we want. You would never... I mean, can you imagine the lawyer advertising, "Oh, yes, I seek compromise. I want to get to a fair result," especially if you're the wrongdoer.
Right.
Yeah, you're the wrongdoer, and you got some wishy-washy wimp. That's Yeah, they beat it out of you in law school.
There's something weird about the specter of a Johnny Cochran who takes Michael Jackson, who's about to fry, who's about to be nailed by the courts, and basically comes up with an agreement that saves the day. Comes to the attention of the OJ defense team. They bring him on board, and he pulls another miracle off, and then becomes a famous man on the court on court TV. When to the rest of the nation, what he did was a very odious thing.
Yeah, isn't it amazing too? And one of the things attorneys always forget, because half the time they're speaking in Latin and really not understanding what in the world is going on, is that somebody like Johnny Cochran can come in and just with a little witty saying put something in the minds of these jurors who probably just, their mind has been numbed after listening to days and days and weeks of testimony. You know, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. I mean, it sounds like something that Dr. Seuss would come up with, yet it worked.
It's amazing how a well-turned phrase can totally obscure everyone's mental processes. Not just in law, just in another example to get the lawyers off the hook momentarily. Friend of mine, ex-friend of mine, worked for the various HMOs lobbying for them, and he would go out and give talks and explain why it was really great that, you know, that they weren't going to provide any care once they took the money. And when his group of doctors more or less said, isn't this sort of an incentive for you to deny care to people? And he would look at the audience and sort of smile and come back with no, this is an incentive for you to keep people healthy. I looked at him with admiration, like, that's brilliant. That's such a load of bull, but it so obscures everyone's thinking process. They'll come away going, yeah, I guess you're right. It is an incentive to keep everybody healthy.
Yep. It's amazing. You learn pretty quickly that if the facts are on your side, argue the law and the facts. And when you have nothing else, go for emotion. Go for emotion and justice. It isn't fair to do this to this person. You get away with it sometimes. It's amazing.
Well, the summary I heard was that when the law's on your side, you pound on the law. When the facts are on your side, you pound on the facts. And when neither's on your side, you pound on the table.
Yep, that works. And you look adamantly at the jury with big eyes and say, you can't do this. It's not right.
This is a mother's son who was once a tyke playing by the river, and he was young, and now he's...
And look at this glove. It doesn't fit. Next thing you know, you actually have people believing it.
Well, Stuart, I wanted to talk a little bit about DNA evidence, but I think we're out of time. So will you come back and do that?
Oh, I'd love to, Doug. That's a fascinating topic.
It all passes far too quickly. I am your host, Douglas Everett. This show was produced by Edward McMillan, and I was assisted today in the booth by Zlatko Palaska. As she always does at this moment, Gina is currently preparing to follow in our footsteps here on her show, Electricity and Lust. So stick around for that, and we will see you next Thursday at 5:00 on 90.3 FM. This was Radio Parallax.